This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the New Books in Disability. Today, I feel very happy to introduce Dr. Janice Rieger to join us to introduce her newest book, Design, Disability, and Embodiment. So, the first thing I want to do today is to invite Dr. Rieger to introduce herself to us.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today to chat with you about my new book. And it's very exciting to share that with your broad audience. Just a little bit about myself. Since 1994, I've been working in disability studies and creating cultures of inclusion. As a young child, I grew up with a grandmother that was blind. And so I think it really impacted me as a young child to see how exclusionary the world is, how exclusionary the built environment is, and the kind of systemic ableism, even at that young age, that was apparent to me. And so I think for a long time, even as a child, I knew that I was going to work in creating better access and inclusion for people with disabilities in the built environment. So I went to university for far too many years, got far too many degrees, and excited that I've been able to work across Canada, the United States, Europe, and now in Australia in creating more access and inclusion and really justice for people with disabilities.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. So I very appreciate you discuss on your introduction of the origin of you interested in studying disability. So for next question, now let's turn to your book. So for your book, my first question is that I want to write you talk about how to reach through embodiment in order to pursue a new trajectory through embodied mapping.
So this is an area that I'm really interested in. And the idea of the embodied mappings is actually a methodology that I have created. I started it during around 2014, and I've really started to publish on it and hone in on it. And it's this idea that we have this kind of embodied knowledge, which, you know, I refer to as techne, which comes from the work of some of my scholars and mentors. And this idea that we can't understand people's lived experience of disability without understanding their embodied experience within environments or within the various kinds of experiences they have. And so this idea of mappings or embodied mappings, I've started to use throughout all of my research. And it actually has this kind of eight-phase approach where the M stands for the multimodal and multisensorial. And so it's important that we look at these multisensorial understandings of the way people with disabilities understand spaces and understand their lived experience and their different knowledge systems. The A in mapping stands for altering. It's this idea that we need to think about the altering of our approaches and the way that we do research with people with disabilities. The P and the other P are performative and pressing. So again, this idea of an embodied criticality and performative understandings of moving through space. The I, of course, in mapping stands for inclusion, and it's about including people with disabilities in all of our research. So the idea about not about us, without us. The N is navigating and narrating. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but it's this method that I've created in terms of working with people with disabilities called dialoguing while wandering. And it's how we move and co-constitute knowledge together. The G of mappings is generative, which means that we need to co-constitute information and research together as one. And the S is surrendering. And the idea of it's really important that we go beyond our own assumptions and our own biases and stigmas and think about other people's experiences and risk ourselves at these kind of moments of unknowingness. And so I've created this methodology and these methods around embodied mappings for us to start to reimagine what research in disability studies can look like.
Okay, thank you so much, Brianza. For the next question, I'm wondering how sound and soundscape map onto ecology in the space, heal, enlighten, and produce identity and shape new way of knowing and the spatial justice.
Well, thank you very much. It's interesting because my work in sound and kind of acoustomology has been ongoing since the early 2000s, actually. My master's degree was around sound art and this idea of the power of sound and the power of acoustics. And primarily it's to destabilize and to, you know, privilege vision. And because a lot of my work actually is working with people who are blind or have low vision, I realized for a long period of time the importance of sound. So not only in the way that people use echolocation to situate themselves or the tapping of their white cane, but also the way that even able-bodied people use sound to navigate, but also use sound as a differing knowledge system. So my work in sound and soundscapes has started to translate it to how architecture and design allows us to see sound almost and understand sound and how it allows us to navigate through those spaces and create these kind of alternate identities. And so I'm kind of bringing in critical disability studies with acoustomology studies to reimagine spaces and places beyond, again, these kind of ocular-centric notions of space and place. And my work in this chapter looks at Canadian War Museum and Canada Sports Hall of Fame and how these particular sounds direct and navigate us through those spaces, and also how sound can either be exclusionary or inclusionary depending on the way that it's created and depending on, you know, the users and their abilities as well. So it's a really fun chapter. I got really excited about it because I was bringing together about 20 years of my work in sound and this idea of an anthropology of the senses. So I think readers will really find it opens up a lot of new trajectories for them in kind of this anthropology of the senses and acoustomology.
Thanks so much. So for the next question, I'm wondering why you talk about how policy development often viewed as opinion medium by which to enact change and to create inclusion within the field of inclusive design.
Thank you for that. So this chapter looks specifically at this idea of co-creating inclusion through short films and this understanding that, you know, most of us doing disability studies work sometimes don't think of ourselves as policy people. And I myself don't think of myself as a policy person, right? I come from architecture and design and creative practice. But the more and more I engage in critical disability studies and the more I work with people with disabilities, I've realized that the way that we can make really systemic change is through policy development. And so what I've realized, though, is when we have these large policy documents, even if they are translated to easy English or plain language, they're still not accessible for so many people with disabilities that it's actually impacting upon. And so no one wants to read a very long document, right, that's created by a policymaker or government. So what I started to do is I started to use creative research methods and creative methods to reimagine how we can impact upon policy. And so I've started to create these short films and co-design them with people with disabilities. So one of the films is called Wandering on the Braille Trail, and it's about bringing notice to policymakers and urban planners and city governments about how people who are blind or have low vision navigate urban spaces through the Braille Trail. And so Sarah, who is blind, and my colleague Megan and I, we filmed ourselves walking and dialoguing while wandering on the Braille Trail so that we can then use that film. It's only a short film. It's about 6 minutes long, to present that to policymakers, to present that to audiences of people with disability, to present that to city councillors and government workers and educators. So what I've found is that film and video is a much more accessible medium to impact policy development and impact real systemic change for people with disabilities. And so this chapter really starts to unpack that, and it invites actually the readers to rethink about using film and video. I'm not a filmmaker, of course, and I've done animations as well. I'm not an animator. But by bringing in those people with those expertise, we're actually able to create a much more inclusive medium for disability studies.
Thank you so much. So after talking about the policy developments, I'm wondering, what we talk about something about privilege, I'm wondering about how the artist, the general party, the constructs the privilege of the visual over all other corporate real senses in her work.
Yeah, this is an interesting chapter, actually, chapter 5. And this actually comes out of my master's research from some time ago that I never really had the opportunity to unpack and to publish on. And so because my work around inclusion and disability, has been happening since 1994, obviously I had, years and decades of work that I had not shared with audiences before. And so I was quite excited to write on this work that I had done from almost 20 years ago, actually, and how interestingly it was still very relevant today. And this again goes back to my interest in sound and that kind of acoustics and the interesting idea of the museum as this kind of ivory tower and the museum space as this privileging of vision, privileging of people who are able-bodied, privileging of people who are of higher education. And the museum is always this understanding of a white cube. And the kind of protocols around being in a museum, so you're supposed to be quiet and you have a certain distance that you're supposed to view artwork from. And so Janet Cardiff's work is a sound piece. It's an installation work that's quite loud and it makes you wander around with these different voices. And so it really allows this interruption of this ableist space and this ableist kind of architecture and this ableist museum through sound and through this really interesting kind of almost critical disability studies narrative. I mean, obviously Janet Cardiff as an artist was not necessarily looking at, being critical of disability and ability, but my interpretation of her work has done just that. And so I think it's really a great chapter for academics and students and practitioners and anyone interested in understanding how we can think beyond vision at these more embodied and corporeal senses and in understanding people's experience. So really quite a fun chapter. The other thing about that chapter, which is really interesting, is a bit different, that chapter, and it's inclusive of intertextuality. And by that, I mean, I wrote this so it's my voice and this kind of poetic embodiment weaving in with more academic voice. So it's a really interesting chapter in terms of the different ways that we can write as writers. This, of course, this work that I'm doing, of course, is this kind of ableist and feminist critique called Feminine Écriture by Hélène Cisseau. And it's me kind of entangling my academic voice with a poetic voice, a poetic embodiment. So the reader will see these kind of poetic interjections, which, again, is kind of deconstructing this understanding of writing as a very privileged ableist medium, and just bringing in my kind of reveries and my thoughts, you know, as it weaves through. So again, a really interesting example of how we can think beyond academic writing.
Thank you so much for your answer. For the chapter 6, I'm wondering about the new ways of designing for people with disability through a co-constitutive clinical assess approach.
So yeah, so this is something I've been exploring only over probably the last year or two. So this is quite a new direction for my work. And it's a critical access approach. And this idea that the way that we design for people with disabilities is primarily based, so these are architects or designers, urban planners, really anyone who's in design, even industrial designers, fashion, anything that we make in terms of material culture. And the understanding that this is often done through guidelines or building codes or, you know, prescriptive measures, which are devoid of the lived experience and knowledge of people with disabilities, right? So we don't know how sometimes these building codes come into place. Very often they have this imaginary user, which is often able-bodied, or if they are disabled, they're often only representative of someone in a manual wheelchair. And so they're really quite at an arm's length or distance from the true lived experience of people with disabilities. And so in this chapter, I talk about two different ways that I've kind of intervened in the idea that we understand how to create better access and inclusion. I give an example in Australia that I did with the QT Art Museum, where I worked with two people who were blind and had low vision, and we kind of wandered while we were walking through the space and audio recorded and video recorded our wanderings, which I then made into a film as kind of this post-occupancy evaluation of the space and how their lived experience and their embodied experience of the space could be used to train curators and architects and students and designers to better design for people with those particular disabilities. The other example is a great example I did with my colleague Mark in Canada. And we did something we call dis audits. So it's this idea of not doing an access audit, but actually dissing the idea of an audit or disability audit. So we were working in a university that had hired an expert to do an accessibility audit. And then, of course, that audit was put away in some file cabinet, probably never to be put into the actual built environment. So because Mark was blind and had worked at that institution for a long time, him and I decided to do a design intervention, almost an activist campaign. And we tagged up the university in terms of areas that were really hazardous for people with disabilities, areas that needed attention in terms of creating better access and inclusion for the students with disabilities and staff. And so these were our ways of together with people with disabilities co-constituting a critical access approach and this being critical of the kind of accessible audits that are often done without people with disabilities. So my approach is co-designed always with people with disabilities. And so that chapter is quite fun. It's quite kind of revolutionary. It's quite activist. And I encourage others to kind of take up the cause and try to understand these critical access approach and these dis audits.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So
You want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
So thank you so much. So after talk about the new ways that's turned to something old. So I'm wondering about the history of spatial histories and its relationship to ableism and the canon.
Yeah, absolutely. So in addition to being, you know, in architecture and obviously a designer and practicing in that space and really pushing for future trajectories and new ways that we can rethink how to kind of deconstruct ableism and the systemic bias, I also am a historian. So for years, I taught art and architectural history across Canada and here in Australia as well. And it's been really interesting for me over the last two decades, because when I started to study history, of course, there was nothing about people with disabilities in our art and architectural history courses. But even during that period of time, probably 25 years ago, there was also not a single female artist or architect in any of our books. So we've come a long way in the last two decades. And in terms of understanding, you know, and critiquing this Eurocentric Western canon, often of male, white, European, you know, exemplars of people that we're supposed to look towards, and started to open up to more of a global history, but more than anything, started to open it up to alternate histories or untold histories. And so I'm quite excited by this chapter and then some of the other work that I've been doing over the last couple of years, because I decided that I was sick and tired of architectural and design history being taught through this very white, ableist, male lens, and that it was time to reinvent the way that we teach history. And it was time to do that through critical disability studies and an ableist lens. And so to my knowledge, I think I'm one of the only people to teach kind of architecture and design history through a spatial justice kind of ableist lens. And so I rewrote all the curriculum, which I have put in this book. So it's a great chapter for academics, for historians, for even architectural and design critics, but also people doing work in disability history and critical disability studies. Because I taught the students essentially about how architecture is ableist, and how architecture has been ableist since the very beginning of time. And it's segregationist and exclusionary. And so when we look at that lens and we look at different periods of time, when we look at different styles, I point out these kind of ableist biases. And so it's pretty exciting to bring in these new perspectives of power, these new perspectives of ableism, and reinvent the way we talk about spatial histories and deconstruct this very, very old kind of canon that we've inherited.
Thank you so much. For the next question, I'm wondering about how museums and galleries have made efforts to be more inclusive over the last 10 years, primarily through the emphasis on video studies.
Yeah, this chapter is interesting because it's, again, it's bringing in some of my newer work as well in terms of looking at inclusive ecologies. So my PhD and some of my postdoctoral work was around ecologies and ecological thinking. And so outside of what we think about ecologies in terms of biology and natural systems, my work looks at this more of a human ecology and this understanding that we operate within this system. And obviously, in terms of people with disabilities, and we operate within a very ableist system. And so understanding how we can map the micro and macro of ecologies allows us to make really significant changes and, you know, really, really just environments and inclusive environments. And so this chapter looks at this kind of idea of careful co-designing in more than human worlds. So this chapter brings in some of my work that I've recently been doing in post-qualitative methodologies, as well as kind of actor network theory and this idea of human and non-human actors, and how when we talk about disability, we have to talk about the things that impact upon people with disabilities. So chairs or stairs or, you know, right-handed scissors, for instance, for people who are left-handed, and all of the things that we create that are not human that actually are exclusionary for people with disabilities. So in this chapter, I particularly dissect that understanding of careful co-designing and inclusion through museum and gallery studies. And I talk about how it's important for us to move really through this, beyond this idea of visitor studies. So a lot of museums and galleries try to create better access and inclusion by just having visitors fill out cards about their experience, right? Which isn't a really good understanding of the embodied experience, especially of people with disabilities. So my work questions that, and it puts the emphasis on co-designing these kinds of new understandings of museums and galleries with people with disabilities. And this understanding that we move from this idea of fixing, right, this idea that codes, guidelines, and visitor studies are quite fixed, to this idea of sharing, where we start to share our stories a little bit more, but again, there's still that kind of distancing of someone with disabilities sharing their story and then it being interpreted, to this idea of caring. And that caring concept is co-designing with people with disabilities. Again, that idea, not about us, without us. And so this chapter is really good for many different audiences, and especially those working in museum and gallery work.
Thank you so much. But last question today, I want you to talk about what spatial justice is, the future of spatial justice. It's the relationship between power, allyship, and DFA.
Yeah, this is interesting again, because this comes from some of my research that I did with the spatial history students here in Australia. And so over a period of a couple of years, I surveyed the students, the first year students in architecture, landscape architecture, and interior design or interior architecture. And I asked them what they thought spatial justice was. And a lot of them didn't really know at the beginning of the unit. And then after we had talked about how spatial justice is manifested in the built environment, they really started to understand their designs quite differently. They understood that designing for inclusion and access is not just about following code or guidelines. It's about understanding it from a justice-based lens, that everyone has a right to access and take part in, you know, society. And that when designers and architects design things that are exclusionary, they're actually creating ableist design and ableist architecture. And so by the students starting to understand a justice-based lens to their work, and not just social justice, but that spatial justice, that justice is absolutely manifested in the built environment. And this idea of power and this idea of perspectives of power and how power is also manifested in the built environment. So, you know, depending on whether we're in a wheelchair and we approach a set of stairs, that power is manifested in the design of those stairs. Whether, you know, we are blind and we come across, you know, various obstacles in the built environment, again, that power has been manifested and designed into those spaces. So my work in this chapter is moving that beyond, thinking differently about the relationships we have with space, with architects and designers, and with people with disabilities, and looking at this understanding of allyship, which again, I think is quite new to the understanding of architecture and architectural design, because I think it's important that architects become allies, disability allies, that we don't have that distancing and that imaginary person with disability when we design, but actually that we become allies and embedded into our communities and embedded into the social structures and the service providers of people with disabilities around us, so that we can be good allies, so that when we go to design, we're actually doing that with people with disabilities through that allyship model. Another thing that I've presented in the book is this concept of design for all, which again comes from Europe and comes from the European Institute of Design and Disability. For many people in North America, in Australia and other parts of the world, design for all is actually a very new concept or a new term, because most of us are familiar with universal design or inclusive design. But I actually think Design for All is the new direction that we're going to be going in, and it's more inclusionary of all people, of all abilities. And so I talk a little bit about Design for All, give a little bit of a history there, and talk about Design for All in relation to spatial justice and the future of the work that we're doing in critical disability studies and how we can think more broadly about what we've been doing for the last 50 years and think quite differently through co-design and through the embodied and lived experience of people with disability.
Thank you so much for answering again. So at the end of our episode today, I want to directly talk to our audience. So I want to say, as a disability historian or disability scholar in a general sense, I learned a lot from Dr. Janice Rieger's newest book, Design, Disability, and Embodiment. And I think everybody with any interest in either design study, architectural studies, disability study, and the intersection or interaction between those field subjects, I highly recommend you should buy a copy and read this one, and read a copy of Dr. Janice Rieger's newest book. Again, I want to repeat the title, The Design, Disability, and Embodiment. It's a fantastic book, and as a disability, while I'm a historian, I still learn a lot, disability historian, I still learn a lot from reading this fantastic book about design, about disability, about architecture. So thank you so much for listening to our episode today. Have a good day.